long members, Mrs. E.T. Rogers, died on February 14th. Mrs. Lett thinks that she might have been a member for 50 years, but she was a very enthusiastic member. This season, Vancouver Institute has missed the support of the news columns of the Vancouver Sun. We now appreciate how important that coverage is to us. I say this as president of the Vancouver Institute, not as a judge. The Vancouver Sun hasn't abandoned us completely. They've brought us tonight's speaker. Reverend Canon Ivany is the Alberta Ombudsman. He's a Newfoundlander. There are others.
Good heavens.
He came to Canada for some of his education, and he stayed in Ontario. He became an electrical engineer in Ontario, taking his Bachelor of Engineering at McMaster's. Then he went to Wycliffe College for theology. He took his licentiate and his bachelor's there, and in 1960 moved to Alberta. He was ordained to the priesthood in 1961 and served as rector at several Anglican churches in Alberta. Then he became an Albertan, a very involved Albertan, and became leader in many fields. In 1973, he received his Doctor of Divinity degree. And then in 1974, a new chapter opened for him. He was appointed Ombudsman in Alberta. Since then, he has hosted the first international conference of ombudsmen. He has spoken widely here and in Europe on the subject. And in this year, he was reappointed for a further term by a unanimous vote of the Alberta legislature. I'm sure that's a rare occurrence. Might be, not be rare in the future. Tonight, Dr. Ivany has agreed to speak to us on the role of the Ombudsman, past, present, and future. Dr. Ivany.
I feel like Billy Graham. I understand that he speaks in auditoriums like this at great length. However, thank you for inviting me. It's great to get out of frozen Alberta into wet Vancouver. I recognize that the speaker this evening was to have been Connor Cruz O'Brien, a man of no mean reputation, and you will have an opportunity, I understand, to hear him on another occasion. And Mrs. Nimitz, when she wrote, was kind enough to remind me in her letter that Dr. O'Brien was indeed an ombudsman in his own right, and this is certainly borne out in a reference that I read of him in the biography of Brian Faulkner by David Bleakley. I've been told, Mr. Chairman, that this is a lecture this evening, and shall try to fulfill those terms. I suppose it means, first of all, that at some point somebody will ring a bell. In after-dinner speeches, I always worry about time, but I'm told that that's not a problem here. I've heard some interesting stories about after-dinner speakers, and a couple of years ago, a friend and I were having dinner in Toronto, and the guest speaker was Lord Salmon from the House of Lords in Britain, and he told a story of a guest speaker in England who I will be careful not to emulate. He had far too much to drink, and he could barely be heard, and he went on interminably. And when he eventually sat down, he leaned over and he said to the chairman, "How was I?" And the chairman said, "Oh, you were Rolls Royce." And the chairman's wife leaned across and she said, "How could you say that? You're nothing but a hypocrite. That's the worst speech we've ever heard." And the chairman said to his wife, "I didn't lie to him. I told him he was Rolls Royce. He was well oiled, barely audible, and lasted forever." A few months ago, I was invited to speak at an ecumenical occasion, and when it was over, the minister of the church told the audience that I would answer questions. Well, in church, nobody asks questions, I've learned over the years. And as I was about to leave the sanctuary, a little boy put up his hand, and he was just down in front. He said, "I have a question. Why'd you talk so long?" You see, question periods are dangerous things, as we probably shall see at the end of our lecture this evening. Well, I have been given a task to speak about the Ombudsman. And this is the most appropriate time in this province because you are about to experience the concept of ombudsmanship for the first time. The choice of the Select Assembly, the Select Committee of the British Columbia Legislative Assembly, of Dr. Carl Friedman as its nominee as ombudsman is one, I think, of great merit. Dr. Friedman has been one of the most active academics in the field of ombudsman studies, and he will bring to this new task a fine theoretical appreciation of the concept and its application throughout the world. He is in the process of writing a book, which will be out, I understand, the next year. In British Columbia, he's faced with a great challenge, not only in the diversity of British Columbia and its vastness, but in the piece of legislation under which he will function. The Ombudsman Act for British Columbia is one of the most forward-looking statutes of its kind. And I say this not because I'm addressing you here this evening. I'm saying it because I have studied the Act, and indeed many of us, not only in Canada but overseas as well, have looked at it very carefully. Now, I must confess that the nomination of an Albertan to the position of Ombudsman in British Columbia, the last major province to embrace the concept, instills in me a degree of parochial pride. The institution in Canada, and indeed in North America, has its roots in the appointment of Dr. George McClellan as Ombudsman in Alberta on September 1, 1967. George McClellan, of course, was almost a divine choice, and that's not a term that I normally use about the decisions of committees. Nonetheless, he was a man for the time. Although in some of the media, when he was appointed, decried the appointment, they were later quick to retract and to give him due credit for an outstanding job well done. Whither goes the ombudsman? In many senses, that question finds a partial answer right here in British Columbia under the BC Ombudsman Act. In the span of 12 years, much has happened in the field of ombudsmanship. When he assumed duties, George McClellan was one of a mere handful of such officials throughout the world. Persons who filled an office, to quote the International Bar Association definition, an office provided for by the Constitution or by action of the legislature or parliament, and headed by an independent high-level public official who is responsible to the legislature or parliament, who receives complaints from aggrieved persons against government agencies, officials, and employees, or who acts on his own motion, and who has the power to investigate, recommend corrective action, and to issue reports. In September 1967, the ombudsman was restricted to 7 focal points in the world: Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, New Zealand, Great Britain, and Alberta. They were joined later that year by New Brunswick. Today, the concept is found in all Canadian provinces except Prince Edward Island, and may soon be found on the federal level, which currently has the ombudsman-like offices of the Commissioner of Official Languages, the Federal Correctional Investigator, and the Privacy Commissioner, the latter two of which would, under the legislation that unfortunately died on the order paper last year in Parliament, would be incorporated under a federal ombudsman scheme. Australia rivals Canada in its passion for ombudsman, there being a Commonwealth or federal ombudsman, and ombudsman in 5 states in Australia: New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia, Victoria, Western Australia, and in the Northern Territory. Yet the explosion in interest in the concept has gone far beyond Canada and Australia. There are now in excess of 60 ombudsmen or ombudsman-like offices throughout the world. They are to be found at the national, state, and local levels in Switzerland, Germany, Israel, in Papua New Guinea, Tanzania, and Zambia, to name but a few. In 1976, as you've already heard, I had the privilege of hosting the first International Ombudsman Conference ever held. 43 ombudsmen and women came to that conference in Edmonton from around the world. From that beginning, there emerged an International Ombudsman Steering Committee comprised of 9 representatives of worldwide ombudsman jurisdictions. And it's my joy to serve as the chairman of that committee. Additionally, the International Ombudsman Institute has now been set up in the Faculty of Law in the University of Alberta. And this serves the ombudsman community through seminars, publications, research, and in many other ways. As chairman of the International Ombudsman Steering Committee, I've been able to visit colleagues in many parts of the world, and it's certainly my firm belief, after viewing their offices and being involved with them, that any office of the ombudsman should not be static, either in its approach to day-to-day operations or through its legislative base. It has to be prepared to meet the changing needs placed on it by the citizens it serves. In 1980, next year, in the fall, the second International Ombudsman Conference will be held in Jerusalem, Israel. To the query, what is an ombudsman? My colleague from New Brunswick, Mr. Joseph Berube, has suggested the office is designed to ensure that the citizens' obligation to obey the spirit and the letter of the law is balanced by the corresponding obligation on the part of public servants. One of the most popularly accepted statements on the role and duty of an ombudsman is encompassed in the reasons for judgment of the Honorable Chief Justice J.V.H. Mulvane of the Supreme Court of Alberta, who just last week resigned his office there. In the matter of the Ombudsman Act, Mr. Justice Mulvane observed, "I am satisfied that the basic purpose of an ombudsman is the provision of a watchdog designed to look into the entire workings of administrative laws. The ombudsman has no power of reversing any decision or of compelling an action or prohibition of any action. His function is to investigate and report with necessary recommendations. The ombudsman can bring to the legislature his observations on the misworking of administrative legislation. He can also focus the light of publicity on his concern as to injustice and needed change. It must, of course, be remembered that the ombudsman is also a fallible human being and not necessarily right." I always add there in parenthesis that that's especially true if he happens to be a clergyman. However, Justice Mulvane goes on, "however, he can bring the lamp of scrutiny to otherwise dark places. even over the resistance of those who would draw the blinds. If his scrutiny and observations are well founded, corrective measures can be taken in due democratic process. If not, no harm can be done in looking at that which is good. The Ombudsman's mandate, ladies and gentlemen, is to arrive at truth, to arrive at equity, to use reason, criticism, persuasion, and publicity to see that justice is done. The Ombudsman concept is frequently regarded as a component of modern trends in democratic government. It is rather very much like the governmental process of which it is part, the product of a continuing evolutionary process with origins dating from those of the first sophisticated governmental organisms. The Roman satirist Juvenal asked, "Who governs the governors? During much of the Roman Republic, two censors, magistrates appointed for a stated term, scrutinized administrative actions and heard complaints regarding alleged maladministration. During the Han Dynasty in China, there existed a continuous control system termed the Control Yuan. Its function included the supervision of administrative officialdom and the hearing of public petitions against administrative injustice. In Russia, Peter the Great in 1722 appointed a procurator who, as eye of the Tsar, would ensure the enforcement of laws and edicts and protect the people from excessive official action. Some 9 years earlier in Sweden, the monarch had appointed an ombudsman for the basic reason, a legal safeguard for the executive branch relative to the administration. The historical origins of the ombudsman institution in its contemporary form are found in Sweden in 1809. The Swedish Parliament, as an expression of independence from the king, appointed a parliamentary agent of justice, an ombudsman, to receive complaints from the public about alleged bureaucratic mistakes, abuse, and incompetence. The modern explosion of interest in the concept may be traced to an ever-expanding role of government in society today, and in inadequacies in the traditional safeguards of justice and redress, in particular, elected legislatures and the courts. I'm often asked to define the relationship between the ombudsman on the one hand and the elected member of the legislature or parliament on the other. In the first place, it should be remembered that the ombudsman is a creation of the legislature. He is a functionary of their making. He is answerable only to them. He is responsible to them. His budget is approved by them. Each member of the legislature is an ombudsman in his own right, with particular responsibility to his own constituency and to his own constituents. In other words, I suppose they are my fellow ombudsmen. They would have had power to confer upon each one of themselves, had they deemed fit to do so, the right to enter government offices, to examine files and to conduct hearings, to subpoena witnesses, to take evidence under oath. But this would not have been a workable arrangement. It would lead to chaos, and the work of the civil service would be ground down to a halt. Accordingly, they confer upon one person, upon the ombudsman, those powers. And I exercise those powers as trustee for them and for the people. As my office evolves and as the powers conferred upon the ombudsman are exercised by my office, we build up a know-how and an expertise which we share with our fellow ombudsman. During my discussion involving the relationship between ombudsmen and elected politicians, I can't help but recall a conversation that I enjoyed with Joey Smallwood, former premier of Newfoundland, the last living father of Confederation. Joey expressed the sentiment that being an ombudsman would be a great opportunity for a retired politician. And he raised this in the context of the ombudsman's duty to criticize government for apparent errors and omissions caused by the administration. And at that point in the conversation, he paused and came to a dramatic halt, tilted his head ever so lightly, and raised his eyebrows heavenward, announcing almost as if he were speaking to God and before the television cameras, that such an appointment wouldn't be appropriate for him because, after all, he wasn't about to retire. The ombudsman enjoys certain advantages, it seems to me, over either of these means. The legislator's primary function is to do what his title suggests, to legislate. Constituency service remains a valuable segment of his day-to-day work, and it provides a hands-on sense of problems facing those that he was elected to represent. He does not possess certain essential tools available to ombudsmen. Although an officer of the Legislative Assembly, the ombudsman is a totally independent figure, free from the entanglements of governmental administration. He also enjoys the legislative mandate to have access to and is able to review all relevant files, save those of the Executive Council. He is able to subpoena witnesses, if necessary, and to take testimony on oath, if necessary. Another traditional means of remedying grievances has been the courts. And yet, in spite of the best efforts of the courts, and they have been great, their administration and legal aid systems, the litigation can still be very costly and often protracted and slow. Dr. Bernard Frank of the Ombudsman Committee of the International Bar Association has emphasized that the ombudsman gives the citizen an expert and impartial agent without direct personal cost to the complainant, without time delay, without the tension of adversary litigation, and without requirement of counsel. Moreover, judicial review is frequently confined to questions as to whether a tribunal or governmental authority has exceeded or declined its jurisdiction, whether there has been an error of law on the face of the record, or whether the applicant has been denied natural justice. In these circumstances, the court will not focus on or examine the merits of a decision, its reasonableness, or its fairness. Where the right of appeal exists under enactment to apply for a review on the merits of the case, the ombudsman in British Columbia, as in Alberta and the other provinces, is excluded from such issues until that right has been exercised or until such time for the exercise of that right has expired. In this sense, the ombudsman institution forms an integral part of the system of formal means of redress for citizens. Dr. Ernest Nebenzahl, the State Comptroller and Commissioner for Complaints from the Public, or the Ombudsman for the State of Israel, has observed in a speech before the Knesset on the fifth anniversary of the introduction of the Office of Ombudsman in Israel, that the ombudsman in principle does nothing that every other public body is not obliged to do. When an executive body receives a complaint against its action or its decision, it has the duty to investigate the matter in the light of the very same criteria that guides the ombudsman: legality and regularity, natural justice, and the welfare of the individual citizen. What differentiates the ombudsman is his almost exclusive occupation with handling complaints. His distance from the pressure of executive tasks the lack of other challenges and ambitions, but achieving maximum results for those who request his aid and the authority to report to an elected body and directly to the public itself. Whither goes the Ombudsman? To return to this question and my observation of British Columbia, through its legislation provides a landmark. There has not only been an explosion of interest in the concept, but additionally, a corresponding growth in its role. The sphere of influence of Ombudsman has been greatly expanded. When it was first introduced to the Commonwealth, the Ombudsman concept was largely restricted to primary levels of government. In New Zealand, Great Britain, that meant to the national government and to its administration. In Alberta, New Brunswick, it meant to the provincial level of government and to its agencies. In New Zealand, the jurisdiction of the office has been expanded to include the local municipal level. New Brunswick has undergone a similar evolution. In Australia, the concept now embraces the Commonwealth, state, and local levels. In Great Britain, there now exists, under the chairmanship of Baroness Sirota, the Commission for Local Administration in England, and a similar body also exists in Wales and Scotland. Local ombudsmen can also be found in Israel, in Zurich, Switzerland. In this sense, the legislation in British Columbia, extending the mandate of the ombudsman to all ministries of the government, to boards and corporations, and authorities who are, or the majority of whose members are appointed by, or are responsible to the government, corporations, majority owned by the government, municipalities, regional districts, public schools and colleges, universities, hospitals, and the governing body of professional and occupational associations established by or continued by an act, places this province at the forefront of ombudsman concept in its contemporary form. It also carries, ladies and gentlemen, a tremendous responsibility and challenge. The Ombudsman is not a panacea to all problems, yet many people perceive it to be so. The search for truth in investigations must always remain paramount. I'm of the firm opinion, gained now, I suppose, from a modicum of experience, that those who serve the public in appointed or public office are not always esteemed as highly as they might or should be. The tendency too often, in my view, is to carp at them instead of trying to understand them and some of the conditions under which they work. Instead of an age of tolerance, we tend towards an age of turmoil, and we hope to solve it through constant confrontation. The public, which has every right to grieve, to question, to have all the information that is available, must also come to act with reason and understanding. There's barely an either-or situation. It is generally a both-and. The highly volatile fringe from both sides must seek reason in their pursuits of justice. The Ombudsman and his staff very often are going to be in the middle. The we and they conspiracy must be calmed. It's our job, the Ombudsman's job, to serve the public, to pose questions, to get answers, to focus the lamp of scrutiny on injustice. Most of the time, people will be satisfied. Occasionally, it will be impossible to satisfy. There are a few people who come to the Ombudsman who will not ever be satisfied. When I came into office in 1974, I began reading a selection of files that had been built up over the previous 7 years. And from these I made a short list of people that I knew I was going to see within a matter of months. And indeed I did. Some of them came several times over the next few years. And my successor in due course will do the same, and they will be there to see him. The Ombudsman Institution is not without its comic moments. Indeed, I think one of the qualifications for an ombudsman is that he ought to have a good sense of humor. If not good, at least adequate. Isn't it Dave Broadfoot, the North Vancouverite, who speaks of the therapeutic use of comedy? The Ombudsman Institution has a place to play there. When Arthur Maloney, Ontario's first ombudsman, came to office, he received a letter from a lady who congratulated him on becoming whatever that thing is you are now. Another letter said that we've needed a good woodsman in government for a long time. And then Charlie Farquharson called him Artie Baloney, your omnibus woodsman. In our office a few years ago, we received a complaint from one of those basic born losers. Everything they touched went wrong. They had a small farm, and they lived in an old abandoned shack on the farm. The day they moved in, the shack burned down. The oil company who had been drilling there had warned them not to move in until they had cleaned the site up. And I suppose that in itself was unique in those days for oil companies. Nevertheless, they moved in. They moved in with some pigs and two cows, as a matter of fact. Within 3 days, the two pigs had died from nosing in the lubricant mud. Several letters came into the office, and we eventually got a road graveled to their farm so they could get in and out and their children could go to school. By this time, they had moved into a transmitter hut, house, I suppose, on the property that was owned by a radio station. The next letter that came into the office complained of the wife's knee pains, which were caused, she said, by scrubbing the floor on cold days. Well, you know, there are even some things that an ombudsman doesn't have jurisdiction over. Then we got a letter saying that they were going to raise blooded cattle, but they needed a fence around their property. And George McClellan somehow got a government road crew to lend them a tractor for a weekend so the husband could dig the holes and put in the posts and erect the fence. The only problem was that when he tightened up the fence with the tractor and he put in the staples in every post to secure the wires, he forgot about them and drove off and attached with the fence attached to the tractor and tore the whole bloody thing down. The last we heard of them, and this is what I was working up to, the last we heard of them was one letter that was the ultimate cry for help. And it read like this: the goat got into the musk keg and hurt her bag. The heifer's been in heat twice and hasn't calved. Mr. McClellan, we need you up here right away. By this time, George McClellan had retired. Just to show you, and I've only brought a few with me, that indeed most of the cases that we handle are of a serious nature. There are some annual reports which I hope some of you will take and perhaps look at. You'll have your own by this time, well, maybe not by this time, but within a year anyway. Whither goes the ombudsman? Certain goals have existed in the past, are present with us today, and towards which all ombudsmen, I think, must continue to strive. In my first annual report as ombudsman in 1974, I expressed these goals as availability, flexibility, and humanization. Availability. An ombudsman has to show, above all else, that he is accessible to all who seek him, and more important, to those who are uncertain about seeking him. As Dr. Louis Marceau, the former ombudsman for Quebec, put it, an ombudsman should clearly be available for more than to receive complaints. His availability should be apparent, in all his attitude toward those who turn to him. Flexibility. Any individual ombudsman should be prepared to rapidly adjust to encounter changes in the administrative process and in society in general. Perhaps more than any other part of the social structure, the office of the ombudsman must be dynamic, not simply because change is a goal in itself, but rather in a constant effort to be effective in its work. Humanization. Society has become increasingly impersonal. An ombudsman must act as a humanizing agent. Dr. Nebenzahl, to quote him again, says the challenge posed by the dual role of the ombudsman. Nebenzahl says to the complainant and the body complained against, the ombudsman must appear possessed of authority and influence. The former will not turn to him, and the latter will not heed him unless this be so. At the same time, the ombudsman must take the place of the citizen vis-a-vis the bureaucrat and present the citizen's case convincingly and forcefully. And this he will not be able to do unless he understands the complainant's situation thoroughly and identifies with him. I agree with Dr. Nebenzahl, and I would add a cautionary note, familiar, I think, to all ombudsmen. One's commitment to a case must not be allowed to color one's reason and the desire for truth as well as justice. As my colleague from Israel concludes, the ombudsman must be objective too. If not, at best, his work will be inefficient. At worst, he will be left without influence. For at the ultimate, the sole power of an ombudsman is to recommend. He does not decide, change action, or cause redress, save through investigation, persuasion, and argument. And this, to me, is the genius of the ombudsman concept. The ombudsman has no power save to investigate and to recommend. Somebody said to me a couple of years ago when we set up a select committee in Alberta to study the Ombudsman Act, don't you think that they should give you more powers? Powers to reverse decisions? And I said no, because I think that it's not power that an ombudsman should have. He should be able to persuade and to recommend having investigated. And it is far better to publicize that recommendation, if it comes to that, if it hasn't, if government has not taken action on it. There are also trends in the world of ombudsmanship today that are worthy of note. Several offices exist in what are generally referred to as third world countries, third world nations, or emerging nations. Ombudsman-like functions exist in Tanzania and Zambia. Ombudsman-like in that they are appointed by the president of the country, yet their function is very like that performed by the classical ombudsman. Indeed, they are accorded ombudsman status by most of their international colleagues. In both of these instances, Tanzania and Zambia, the nations are one-party states. In Nigeria, the military government has established a public complaint system. Papua New Guinea is interesting in that, in common with the complaint function, the Ombudsman Commission is responsible for the leadership code, which is entrenched in the Constitution and which lays down a code of conduct in both public and private matters for the nation's leaders to maintain a standard of behavior, and provides a basis for some form of action against persons violating the code. The subject of ombudsman institutions in emerging nations will be one major subject of discussion at the next International Ombudsman Conference. While clearly dealing with differing and often unique situations, the adaptation of the concept in these nations is most worthy of study. Of similar importance in terms of comparative ombudsman studies are the function of ombudsman-like officials in Eastern European nations, notably the Soviet Union and Poland. The Soviet Procurator's Office has not been the focus of much attention by students of the ombudsman concept, and yet some commentators have noted a similarity to traditional notions of ombudsmanship. Another significant trend in terms of the potential future direction of the concept may be found in the recent report of the Australian Law Reform Commission, entitled Complaints Against the Police. Now, I've already mentioned Australia has a federal ombudsman, the state and state ombudsman with local authority. The report of the Law Reform Commission recommends adoption of an ombudsman as an important instrument in the handling of complaints against the Commonwealth Police Force. At the federal level, they express concern over the current wording of the Ombudsman Act and suggest that the Commonwealth Ombudsman should be accorded clear authority to review the merits of complaints against the police. Also recommended is the creation of an internal investigating unit within the police force and an independent police tribunal to deal with instances where police conduct has been found wanting. And on a similar vein in this country, the report of a federal government committee on the concept of the ombudsman and a subsequent proposed piece of legislation, which died on the order paper, foresaw the creation of a federal ombudsman. This ombudsman would have been accorded jurisdiction to handle complaints directed against the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And hopefully this legislation will be reintroduced and enacted by the Canadian Parliament in due course. Frequently, questions have been posed as to future directions of ombudsman concepts in relation to freedom of information, a subject about which I'm sure you have all heard a great deal. Some have suggested that the enactment of ombudsman legislation has reduced the need for freedom of information legislation, arguing that through the ombudsman, citizens are provided indirectly access to information. Now, I don't think the ombudsman is a substitute for freedom of information, nor is it fair to suggest that the ombudsman, in a sense, provides the citizen with access to hitherto sacrosanct information. The role of the ombudsman is to investigate complaints, to arrive at the facts, to make recommendations. In that sense, the ombudsman is not a conduit of information. He is certainly not a discovery mechanism in terms of issues that may be pursued in the courts. In general, ombudsmen are very cognizant of their unique role in terms of access to information and that which should properly be provided complainants. Ms. Inger Hansen, who was formerly the federal correctional investigator, touched briefly on this sensitive aspect of ombudsmanship at a Canadian Ombudsman Conference in Toronto by referring to the potential situation where an inmate complains that he has been denied a temporary absence pass to visit his wife. Investigation reveals that the wife is involved in the relationship with another man and has asked the social workers to allow her time to work out the details. Clearly, any ombudsman would have to be very careful in reviewing the extent to which he could provide that kind of information to the complainant or any similar sensitive situation. From another perspective, freedom of information poses serious questions vis-a-vis the ombudsman office itself. To what extent should an ombudsman be subject to freedom of information? And while I favor freedom of information, I remain convinced that many people who approach our office today, in our context as it presently is, would not do so if he or she felt that their case would be the subject of tomorrow morning's newspapers. Now, this is not to say that the ombudsman concept is not compatible in terms of freedom of information. Indeed, in Sweden, the two concepts exist side by side. The ombudsman for Sweden has on many occasions noted that each morning the press attend to his office and look over his new files, at times before he himself has reviewed him. It is an issue which must be approached carefully and with a view to the social context in which we live today. What effect would freedom of information, if implemented, have on the workload of an ombudsman? While we certainly receive cases based solely on a lack of information on the part of the public and a desire to get at it, these are not that large in number. And further, the mere fact it was available might not assist those who would not know how to personally obtain that information. It's been suggested by some with whom I've discussed the issue that the workload of an ombudsman might increase with freedom of information. Disputes over access to information under freedom of information schemes. At the federal level, it has been proposed that the privacy commissioner would become an assistant federal ombudsman. In New Brunswick and Australia, the ombudsman plays a role as an adjudicator in disputes relating to access of information. And in Sweden, the chief ombudsman plays a very important role in that same area. These are but a few indications of what may well be a future direction of ombudsmanship. In May of this year, I will begin a second term as ombudsman for the province of Alberta. And I view a new term as an opportunity to perhaps discover the future. Now, the future to me is not entirely unmanageable, because after all, it'll be nothing more than a set of conditions. And we must always try to influence these conditions in advance. Change in governmental institutions, in the private sector, and other areas will be substantially great over the next several years. The ombudsman institution will also, I suppose, be changed. The incumbents will have to adjust to deal with a new vision, with citizens that are more ready to fight bureaucracy, with a greater number of special and human interest groups, and with a greater public participation in decision making. Bureaucracy will, if it follows the last number of years, bureaucracy will grow. The job of an ombudsman in the future will not be completely unlike the past or present. The responsibility of each ombudsman is to speak for the individual, to make him or her realize that he or she is not alone, and that will remain a constant. I predict that increased emphasis will be placed on the human aspect of our workings. Section 21 of the Alberta Act, and there's an equivalent section in the BC Act, states, where after making an investigation under this act, the ombudsman is of the opinion that the decision, recommendation, act, or omission that was the subject matter of the investigation, A, appears to have been contrary to law, or B, was unreasonable, unjust, oppressive, improperly discriminatory, or was in accordance with a rule of law or a provision of any act, C, was based wholly or partly on a mistake of law, or a law or fact, or D, was wrong. That, to me, is a crucial phrase. The significant section that I feel will play an ever-increasing part in the work of an ombudsman in the years to come. There are several foundations that will serve for ombudsmen of the future, as they have in the past. The first two of these are obvious: justice and mercy. This is an age of science. Huxley once stated that the scientist must be willing to sit down before the facts with the humility of a child. He must be willing to give up every preconceived notion of his own and follow where nature leads. And that is a description of a humble person, not one who thinks that his own preconceptions are bound to be right because he thought of them, but one who must be prepared to put everything that he has learned, everything that he thinks he knows, to the test, and to discard anything that will not stand the test of experiment. A scientist who falsifies his evidence on the basis of his own prejudice is no scientist, and he never achieves anything that's worth having. Obviously, then, the third foundation stone for ombudsman should be one of humility. And humility must extend outside the laboratory. It must be mingled with justice and mercy to create in our world the type of society that we need. In terms of the world of ombudsmen, this ultimate goal is to be found in the effort to ensure that no substantial case of injustice remains unheard. A very important part of an ombudsman's work is contained in the field of the media. Over the past 5 years, the media in our province have been very supportive and helpful to the ombudsman's work. Public knowledge of the ombudsman, his role and his function, is essential if the office is to be an effective tool for citizens in their dealing with inequities and injustices as a result of governmental actions. Increasing this awareness is a difficult task to accomplish. All investigations by the ombudsman in Alberta are to be conducted in private. This is true in British Columbia as well. Open public confrontation is not the hallmark of an ombudsman's work. And while it will no doubt occur from time to time, confrontation is not a general rule. And this has led to some criticism of ombudsmen for having too low a profile, too gentle an approach, and being too polite. Perhaps in some sense there's an element of truth in that. In many cases, the ombudsman's work becomes public only through his or her annual report. Yet in part, these criticisms from the media flow from a lack of appreciation of the nature of the day-to-day work of an ombudsman. The basic role of an ombudsman is that of an impartial investigator, a mediator, and at times an advocate and a fighter. In the vast majority of cases, issues can be resolved at the departmental level in cooperative, low-key, if you like, handling of the issue to the satisfaction of the complainant, the department, and the ombudsman. It must also be kept in mind that justified, rectified complaints form only 25 to 30% of all full and complete investigations. At the same time, the ultimate weapon of the ombudsman, of any ombudsman, is to publicly criticize governmental inadequacies and failings. And when I have to, I can yell just as hard and long as the next fellow. From another perspective, the ombudsman concept has been raised in terms of the media, a watcher for the watchers. In Sweden, there exists a press ombudsman. The report of the Royal Ontario Commission on Violence in the Communications Industry, chaired by the Honorable Judy LaMarche, recommended the adoption of a similar body in Canada. I'm not convinced that the creation of such an office is a proper role for government. I am, however, concerned that the media should take some form of action to establish a watchdog over their own work. I suppose the courts are, to an extent, available, yet they are not necessarily the total answer to any but the most serious of disputes. In a discussion of this issue, Borden Spears of the Toronto Star has argued that media abuses are subject to self-correcting process, the unrestrained mix of ideas published. Now, while in part his argument has a degree of validity, I'm not convinced it is the most appropriate way to deal with possible abuses by the media. Let me conclude this part of our presentation with some general observations that I have gleaned from my ongoing study of the ombudsman concept. And these apply to the present and to the future, and I think that they are forgotten at our peril. First, the ombudsman must not be viewed as a substitute for, but rather as a complement to the executive and the legislative branches of government. The important parameters of public administration, how much power is to be conferred for what purposes upon whom, to be exercised by what means, are primarily questions for political determination. Regardless of how competent an ombudsman may be, no matter how well accepted he may be by the public, he cannot supplant the political processes that in the end control the administration of public affairs. Secondly, it is not the role of the ombudsman to achieve daily sensations by exposing arrogant administrators, bungling bureaucrats, or oppressive officials. Granted, he must be a smiter of the wicked men when, as John Stuart Mill stated it, the despotism of custom rears its ugly head. That sort of convenient despotism, where decisions are made according to the book instead of according to conscience and the merits of the case. But the ombudsman must also be equally a protector of the innocent, and he must quash unwarranted accusations against civil servants who have acted properly. For there can be no doubt that the success of any ombudsman's office can be ensured only by the idealism and the self-respect of the civil service. Thirdly, it is a disservice to the ombudsman to expect too much from him. As the former Danish ombudsman, Professor Stephen Hurwitz, once said, expectations about what ombudsmen can accomplish become too greatly inflated. Their genuine achievements may be forgotten when the inflated expectations explode. More often than not, as the American commentator Walter Gellhorn has stated, ombudsmanship works in small ways its wonders to perform. Too exalted expectations are a disservice to the institution. The ombudsman can be important without always dealing with important matters. An ombudsman's accomplishments are likely to be interstitial. He cannot create a solid structure of public administration. He can only do a bit of patching and sewing of minor rents in a basically sound fabric. Finally, and perhaps of the greatest importance, the ombudsman must always be a person of compassion. For many of those who seek his assistance are more often perplexed by life than victimized by officialdom. I would suspect that many complaints would never reach an ombudsman's office had the original government decision been carefully and emphatically explained in the first place. Sir Guy Poles, the New Zealand ombudsman who has been the incumbent in that office since its inception in 1961 until 1977, once referred to himself as the Auditor General of Human Relations Accounts. In his attempt to provide the individual the attention large organizations must subordinate to considerations of speed and efficiency. To quote Gellhorn again, The Ombudsman's humane response to particular problems serves not only to contribute to the complainant's contentment, but also serves to remind other public administrators en masse that human happiness is the object of government. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, I wish to thank you for providing me this opportunity to come this evening, and further to wish you well as you embark on your first experience with the Ombudsman concept. Thank you very much.
Dr. Ivany has agreed to accept questions. Our usual rule, one to a customer, and would you make them short? First one's up here.
Sir, could you give us a sampling of the different types of complaints that dealt with?
That can be heard, I think.
Sampling of different complaints? That will help you, and I'll hold this one for you, since you asked the question. Every level of government, and I can tell you that the 6 or 7 largest number of complaints in Alberta deal, as you may suspect, with the correction services, with social services and community health, and that deals with a wide spectrum. Items of welfare, yes, but also in many other areas. Many people try to get us involved in the matter of policy where with regard to certain payments with regard to welfare. And of course we don't get into that. The policy sets the payment, not the ombudsman or the administration. Workers' compensation board complaints are very large, but large for us numerically, but not large in relationship to the number of complaints that Workers' Compensation Board handles. Agriculture, of course, in Alberta, take a great amount of time because most of them, being in the rural areas, mean that we have to go out and interview the complainant, and it may be a matter of flooding, it may be a matter of drought. Not that I control flooding or drought, I leave that to somebody else. But it may have been that a bridge to a road has been washed out and something there has to be investigated in the sense that it may not have been put there properly in the first place. I'm amazed at the number of large complaints that do come in from agricultural areas. Those are the largest areas. We then move into transportation. The Attorney General's Department, I would say those are probably the half dozen large areas, but we get involved in all the other areas as well of government. We had recently, just to take the agriculture one, a complaint from a farmer in northern Alberta, where the government a few years ago had put a road into property, and as a result of that road, certain wash-off or runoff areas were blocked, and his land was flooded after even a mild rainstorm. When we don't have experts within our own office, and we don't in this case, we're not afraid to go out and hire experts who can give us a decision. And we found, in fact, that the government was at fault in building this road, not taking into account proper drainage systems and so on. And in fact, they had to dig a great deal of it up and rebuild it. And this took, it was in the winter when he complained to us. It couldn't be done the first part of the spring. It went through the summer and wasn't completed through the fall. But those are the kind of things that sometimes come in that we have to handle. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Mrs. Lett?
We have two offices, one in Edmonton, which is the main office, and one in Calgary. There are 12 people on the staff in Edmonton, including myself, and four in Calgary. There's a total of, there's 14 in Edmonton and four in Calgary. You'd think I hadn't been there for a while, but I have, honestly. That includes stenos, investigators. We have two lawyers, a lawyer in each office, and we have seven investigators altogether. Now, the staff across the country varies. Toronto has a staff of about over 100, and we're dealing with 6 million population in Ontario. Quebec has a staff of about 40, 45, dealing with a similar population. Obviously, they do things a little differently. Manitoba, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, all have staff under a dozen. So it can vary, and the way one handles complaints vary. Some have a lot of investigators, some have a few. Some have legal members of their staff, some ombudsmen or lawyers, some have legal counsel that they hire when they need them. So it varies depending on where you are. You pick them out, then I can't be accused of being partial.
Dr. Agnew, one role that you neglected was that, like the older institution, the church, the institution of ombudsmen has recently contributed to Sunday TV entertainment. But both on TV and in the annual report, one doesn't get a very good impression of what your batting average really is. I mean, you quoted a figure of 25%, but I'm wondering, in the cases that are really substantive, in which you felt strongly, what percentage of the cases did you not succeed in getting any action?
That's a very good question. Let me try to differentiate between entertainment ombudsman and pragmatic ombudsman. I have a great respect for Robert Cooper, and he does an excellent job in the field wherein he operates. He is not an ombudsman. He is a complaint handler, showman. He has to be concerned about his ratings, and that's a fact. He'll tell you that. Because if his ratings drop, he will go off the air. If my ratings drop, I won't go off the air. But there is a difference. There is a difference between a media ombudsman, if you like, and a legislative ombudsman. And I think perhaps it's unfortunate that over the years the word ombudsman has been a catch-all for every complaint handler that exists. Now, to get back to your other question on what is our batting average, on recommendations that we have made. On substantial ones. Okay. My answer to you is that in the last 5 years in Alberta, and I can only speak for Alberta, although I can give you figures for other provinces, 98% of the recommendations that we have made to government have been acted upon, have been approved, and action taken upon them. Now, this has ranged, and I can give you just a few examples. We were involved a year or so ago with a number of small businesses in the province of Alberta who sent in complaints to us. And this involved the hiring of summer students, and a program was canceled shortly, within a month or 6 weeks after they started it. And funding was cut off, and they had to let summer students that they had hired go. We got hold of it because some of the employers felt very badly about this. You don't hire a student for the summer and then terminate him halfway through because he just doesn't get another job. So we looked into this, and we made a recommendation on it that where some 80 students had been let go from small businesses, that they be compensated. And that particular recommendation involved something like $76,000. That recommendation was made prior to the end of the summer and before school or university started again, and was acted upon and carried out so that checks were received by the students before they got back to university. That was one of the largest ones that we've handled. We had another one involving the death of an individual through the Workers' Compensation Board. Claims were made. I made a recommendation to the Lieutenant Governor and Council that the widow be paid a sum of $25,000. The Executive Council came back and said, we'll pay her $10,000. We came up with some more evidence that I hadn't presented originally and went back to the Executive Council, and they said, we still think it should be $10,000, but we're prepared to put it out for a third opinion with a lawyer, which they did. The lawyer came back and said, I think you should have followed the Ombudsman's recommendation and paid her $25,000, and she got her $25,000. Now, most of these recommendations, most of the recommendations of that sort anyway would involve something of an ex gratia payment. And it may range from $100 that we may obtain from for a student who has been involved in summer employment to the $66,000 or $76,000 that I mentioned on the total program, or $25,000 on a complaint, WCB and the widow that was involved. But across the country, on a provincial basis, where there are ombudsmen, I would have to say that the majority of recommendations that are made by the ombudsman to the government are acted upon. He doesn't always get exactly what he wants, but he gets darn close to it. Is that satisfactory? Yes. Is there one particular case in the last 5 years that I would particularly say happened, I guess, as a result of my intervention that may not have happened if our office hadn't intervened? There's one case that I'm particularly happy about. I got a letter. Was about 1976, 75. It was a year after I took office, from a young boy who had been in a motor vehicle accident, had gone over an embankment in the city of Edmonton, and he was paralyzed, basically, so that he could do nothing. He was placed in a nursing home and given a great deal of tender, loving care, but his world ended at the door of the nursing home. He determined that he was going to complete his high school, which he did, and he wanted to go into law at the university. He needed for this transportation, access to a great deal of money, and the fortitude, I suppose, to do the job. The fortitude he provided himself. We got involved in it because it was a welfare case. He was getting a certain amount of money to pay his room and board and to continue an existence, which is basically what it was. He'd asked for a van, you know, the Ironside type vans that some quadriplegics can drive, and they turned him down. They said it was absolutely impossible, that there was no way they could supply him with that. We got it. He wrote to us and said, "Is there anything you can do?" And we got in on the case, and we found through his accident involved the unsatisfied judgment fund. The guy who hit him had no insurance, pushed him over the embankment, or he went out of control, and there was no insurance available to him, so it was the unsatisfied judgment fund. The Attorney General's Department was involved, the provincial welfare was involved, the city welfare was involved, and what I was able to do was to bring all these departments together and say, now look at what you are spending on this man. And it added up to a substantial amount of money. We ended up getting him the van and teaching him how to drive it, and he went over to university, and he last year completed his arts degree, and he's now in law, and he misses classes because he's not well all the time. He can't write. He has to take notes by tape recorder. All sorts of things that one would expect that he couldn't do, but he seems to do them. Now, we have kept in touch with him, of course, over the years, and he's a remarkable boy. But I am convinced, and I'm happy about it, in the sense that probably nobody else would have picked up his case. I don't think the courts could have done it. I don't think a lawyer could have done it. But by being able to bring all of the government departments together, I think we can be fairly proud of the fact that he is going to be a productive human being in society. Now, there are several cases that I could quote you like that, but I think that's the most significant one. As far as the university is concerned in Alberta, we don't have any control. We don't have any jurisdiction. The University of Alberta in Edmonton had an ombudsman for about a 2-year period. He was a professor on staff, and they tried to combine the two offices. It really didn't work. I think the independence aspect must be maintained at all times if you're going to do the function of ombudsman. There has to be a hands-off situation, and you have to stay at arm's length from most things. My own experience has been that from the number of complaints that we receive, even though people know we don't have jurisdiction, I would say that there's a need, perhaps, for an ombudsman of some sort at most universities. I don't think it can be a government ombudsman. The university again is the situation is the organization that should make that appointment. You get involved with it, I suppose. Now the British Columbia ombudsman is going to be involved in it because he has jurisdiction over universities, and it's going to be very interesting to see how he handles it. It'll be the first time in the Western culture that has happened. And I suppose we'll have to wait a few years and just see how things work out. I'm sorry, if you want me to expand or another area that you want me to cover.
One more question.
Oh, sorry.
Dr. Ivory, in the course of your examining a number of cases, you speak of investigation and recommendation, you probably identify some particular pattern of administration of the abuse of power. Do you have any kind of educational role with respect to bringing about corrections and with respect to the structure and function of government?
I think the first thing I'd like to say about that is that In the 12-year history of the office in Alberta, neither my predecessor nor myself have ever found any malice involved in administration or bureaucratic shortcomings or whatever. There has never been that aspect of it. Whether we have an input in an educational process, perhaps sometimes we don't know whether we do or not, but there certainly is an opportunity for one. In making a recommendation, perhaps along the lines of the Auditor General, who is, to my mind, very much of an educator as well as an Auditor General, who makes recommendations and says, look, you know, you really should be doing things this way. Now, perhaps we don't do that quite so much, but there are administrative matters and the handling of administration that I very often will say to them, you know, if this matter had been handled in this way and we had followed this process instead of the way you did it, and sometimes it's a matter of information giving or explaining to an individual why something was done. Give you an example. We had a case a couple of years ago which involved a review panel where a lady had made an application for the subdivision of land, and it was important to her that the land be subdivided, but not from a financial point of view. And she had been turned down, she made the appeal, and the appeal was turned down. And she came into me and she said, you know, those blankety-blank bureaucrats, they never tell you anything. She said, it's important to me to know why I was turned down and how I was turned down. We went back and we pulled the file out and we read it, and the government, she was in a green belt area, and there are rules and regulations set out, and these should be let alone. And they were perfectly right in denying the appeal. What she didn't know was that she had a good deal of support on the committee, because 3 members out of the 7 voted for her. She was just sort of on the edge. But when all was considered, it was decided, albeit unanimously at that point, when everything was explained, that really at this particular time wasn't the time to have that particular plot of land subdivided. Now, 5 years down the road might be a different story. Nobody ever told her that. They sent her a form letter and said, no. You know. Now, if they had taken the time and the energy to write her a letter and to tell her exactly what had transpired, why they did it, and the fact that 3 out of 7 said, well, maybe she's got a point too, I don't think she would have been nearly as upset as she was under the circumstances.
I have asked the publisher of the Vancouver Sun, Mr. C.W. Davy, to thank the speaker for us.
Mr. Davy, just before you do, could I just say to the young lady from the university that I think I may have been inadequate in answering you. I'll be here for a few minutes. If you'd like to come down and see me, I'll gladly talk to you. Okay? I'll stay with you.
I'm only the phantom publisher of the Sun. I haven't published. In fact, I'm one of those media entertainment ombudsmen who'd love to have some ratings to worry about. And I'm sure when we come back, we will be worried about the ratings. But it's a great pleasure for me personally to be associated with the Institute in bringing you here tonight. And I think it's very apt that a person who, if you'd decided to turn to journalism, obviously would have been a great journalist as well as an outstanding ombudsman, should come as the guest of the Sun. And on behalf of myself, the Sun, and the Institute, Dr. Ivany, thank you very much for an entertaining and enlightening address.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Just one postscript for those of you who are worried about the judges, as I know some people here at the front are. It's traditional when a newspaper comes back from a period of non-publication for whatever reason to publish a catch-up section.
Thanks.
We're going to publish two. One will have to do with what's gone on in the world while we were away, and the other will be devoted exclusively to judges.
It's good for the attendance at Vancouver Institute. There's not much else a judge can do Saturday night. Good night.
Oh, good night.